Are you born in Saginaw, and then you, your parents brought you this land?
When I was 14 months old.
When you were 14 months old. So the rest of your life, you spent right here, and in other words,
right.
You're really an Ypsilanti. Where'd you go to elementary school?
I went to Roosevelt.
Did they have an elementary school too?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you were there all the way through then.
Right.
That's right. I knew they had an elementary school.
Yeah. The kindergarten at that time was in Welch Hall, where the, well, it's not there now, but the ROTC department used to be there.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I don't know what's, well, that part of Welch Hall, they tore down when they built that little plaza there between Welch and the McKinney Union, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
But I went to first grade through the sixth grade on the first floor of the Roosevelt building that's up on campus now.
Uh-huh.
And then the high school was up, you know, on the third floor.
Yeah.
And so we really, you didn't have to go outside the building. And the school was so small that all the kids ate in the cafeteria at the same time, and so forth.
And then you, when you were growing up, that was when your mother had the business down there,
right
on Harriet Street. Yeah,
I think they built that store on Harriet in about 1948, somewhere in there. Yeah, because my grandfather, I remember, was at the dedication, and they still have the record that they made at that dedication ceremony that we get out and play every now and then when my folks come over to the house. Because he died in 1949.
Oh.
I was in the fourth grade when he died. My father was born in Ypsilanti, up on First Avenue there. Well, you know, we still own the house.
Yeah, yeah.
In 1895.
Oh.
And my grandfather came to Ipsy from Canada, but prior to going up into Canada, they came up from the south. And I have to go back and talk to my dad about all that movement back and forth, because I don't really recall all the sequences of events in terms of my great, well, it would be my great-grandfather.
Yeah.
But my father's grandfather was, in fact, a slave, and I can't remember specifically about my own grandfather. I believe he was, and that he ended up being a freedman. But when he came to Ypsilanti, he got a job working for the city, and that's how he ended up, you know, being in that crew that helped build that
water tower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was a laborer.
Uh-huh. And evidently your great-grandfather, having come over from Canada, was a laborer too.
Yeah, he was. I'm not sure. I don't recall exactly what he did.
Uh-huh.
Now, my father tells me that his grandfather used to live on 2nd Avenue, right over in that area where Kersey's live now.
Oh, yeah.
Mrs. Kersey, I don't remember her first name right offhand, but she died here a few years back, but she lived in the house there for a long time. I think she was a cook, and my great grandfather's name was John Goodman, but I haven't really heard my dad talk that much about what he did, you know, specifically. I've heard my father talk about what he did as a kid, growing up in the community, hauling coal, and had one of these little carts that he'd push around collecting rags and junk and stuff. He's had a variety of experiences in his life.
Anything that would make you monotonous living.
He's lived in two or three different cities because, of course, he lived in Detroit for a while. He lived in Ohio for a while. And he worked in a coal mine. And then the bulk of his adult life, before he retired, of course, was spent in the factory. So I think when he retired from Ford's, he had about 37 years there at the Ford Motor Company.
Well, now your mother never did work in Ford, right?
No. My mother is from Vienna, Georgia, and we went down through her hometown when we went to Florida over the holidays. But she was a teenager when their whole family came up here. Or I say teenager, she was in the 11, 12, 13-year-old range, somewhere in there. And they moved from Vienna to Ecorse. And a short while after they came north, her mother died because she was ill. Then her father, I don't recall exactly what he did. I know he was a baseball player when he was in the South, but I don't believe it was on a professional team of any sort. But she lived there in Ecorse until, I guess, up to the time she got married. And I guess she's been living in Ypsilanti since, I think, probably the 30s, herself. But she operated a store originally when they first built the house that they live in on Madison Street now. She had a hat shop, or what is it, millinery goods, and then they got the idea after they saved up some money to build a store, which is the one that they went ahead and built down on Harriet Street. And at the time, my father tells me that he had difficulty getting a loan from the savings bank, so he just saved up his money and came up with enough, plus, you know, some of his friends that he knew that had certain skills worked for him. John Bass and Sam Bass's father helped him with the store. What's old man Bass's name? I think he's dead now, but anyway, he was a brick mason.
Oh, yeah.
And he helped him build that store down there. And you know, was Mr. Reeves still living when you all came to Ypsilanti? J.H. Reeves, maybe he died already, but the Reeves family came up from the South, in the mid-40s, I guess, and they built a house kitty corner across the street from where my folks lived, and he had some monies from someplace, because he bought up that whole block, practically, built homes for his whole family between Madison and between First Avenue and Second Avenue. But now, he was a contractor here in Ypsilanti, a cement contractor, and he poured the basement in the floor of the store down there. I remember that. And I think this man is in Ypsilanti now. He's a minister. He's also a contractor named English.
Oh.
I think he lives on Harriet up there someplace. But at any rate, he used to do a little work for my dad. But now my mother, really, she never did work other than in the store.
Yeah.
She ran the dress shop, of course, and he hired two or three ladies in the beauty shop.
Yeah.
The beauty parlor downstairs. That was all she did, really. And that store, they were in business until 64, I think it was, when the Urban Renewal Program came in.
Uh-huh.
And Urban Renewal bought them out. And, of course, they tore that whole area down when they built those Parkview apartments there across from the barbershop. And the store used to sit right across the street there from where Hall's Barbershop is.
I don't Hall did have anything to do with that.
Hall?
Yeah. Or building that area at that time.
No, I don't think so. He built that smaller shop first, but that's the only thing he had there, and then he built those apartments, you know, in the back, I believe. But he's sort of a later addition to Ypsilanti. And I can't remember right now what the general timing period is. I'd say in the mid-50s or someplace back in there was probably when he built that first barbershop.
Do you remember when Ypsilanti elected its first council, black council? Yeah, you don't have any, right?
No, I was too young.
Yeah. Still too young.
That was in the 40s.
That was this guy that recently died in Detroit.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
But then I think your next one then was Washington.
Right. Amos Washington. Well, Amos Washington served on council, and then he also served on the school board.
Right. What kind of guy was Amos Washington?
He was very businesslike. You know, very much very articulate. Had a great. He was a tall guy. You know, kind of slim, bald headed. But was, you know, he was one of these no-nonsense people. He was the manager, or director, rather, of the public housing program when the projects were built up there on Armstrong. And, you know, the man had a good reputation. Of course, he was another one of these blacks, I think, that got in this whole thing that we were talking about earlier as far as, you know, some of them didn't like him because, you know, he had too much close affiliation with the white folks.
Yeah. Even worse than he is now.
Yeah. But, you know, he ran that public housing program and ran it well. And you didn't have all that confusion and what have you back in those days in public housing that you got now, because the public housing project was run efficiently. Didn't see a lot of debris and trash and what have you, and if you didn't pay your rent, you got put out. Simple as that. And of course, he was involved in, you know, a lot of community organizations and so forth. But he was one of the few blacks that I can remember as a kid. Of course, I was really young, but I can remember just in what I can recall other adults in the community reflecting on that I thought he, you know, had made a real good contribution in the community. But I was in a situation, of course, where I would be more apt to hear that kind of discussion simply because of the background that I had and the kinds of people and friends and acquaintances that my folks had at that time.
You were here also when Reverend Smith
was at
Brown Chapel.
Yes, I remember. What
do you remember about him? What kind of guy was he?
Well, Reverend Smith was a very down-to-earth, practical, jovial, but also very intelligent person, and had a good rapport with the older members of the congregation as well as the younger members of the congregation. I remember I was just talking about Reverend Smith the other day when I was in the car with somebody and I was relating my experience going up to Camp Baber right after they had opened that camp in Cassopolis. And Reverend Smith came up that Sunday after the session was over for that week to bring a carload of us back to Ypsilanti. And he was driving down that little two-lane highway, and he was sitting there just holding on that steering wheel and driving 80 miles an hour, I guess, just flying. And he'd come up behind a car, and he'd say, "All right, there's no parking allowed on this highway. If you want to park on this highway, you got to move out of here." But he gave the young people in the church at that time a feeling that their contribution was really significant, and you know, everybody liked him, and he was active in the community. He got involved with the white church groups, you know, the power structure, the big churches downtown, the Methodists and the Baptists and all that. He was the president of their ministerial group and started up that, I think it was Reverend Smith that started the thing that you have now, the Brotherhood Banquet at Brown Chapel.
First Brotherhood Banquet.
But he was just, he was a little good fellow, you know.
Yeah.
He was kind of rotund, but he was short.
Yeah.
And just a fun person to be around. When you was around him, he never gave you the impression that he was a minister.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there was any distance factor because he was a man of the cloth. And very similar, I think, an individual was also Reverend Daniels.
Oh, yeah.
Reverend Daniels also, I believe, of course, see, in Reverend Daniels' case now, I probably had a much closer identification with Reverend Daniels because when he came to town, he brought with him a family, and most of his family, his children, were in my general age range. Like, his older daughter and I are the same age. And his youngest son, James, I remember when he was born, because I was, I guess I must have been 11, 12, 13, whatever that age span is now between us, but Reverend Daniels' kids and myself and our other friends, of course, all sort of participated in the various church activities, the choir and the usher board and different church programs. So the Daniels family has been very close to me personally, simply because we shared, our friendship as far as family members were concerned. And we would visit, and I'd go down there to the parsonage and visit with his family kids. I was just, you know, another one of the members of the household sometime. And then, after Reverend Daniels left, the sequence of ministers, I can't remember. I remember George Powell and Reverend Anderson. There was another older gentleman. Well, Anderson, he didn't die, though, did he? He was rotated.
Yeah.
I don't know where he went. Somewhere, I guess.
Oh, I was... Anderson went to he came to Indiana.
Okay, I was going to say he came, I think I recall, from Indiana.
Yeah. Well, I these are people, of course, I didn't know. Now, right. Washington, you know, went to Lincoln.
Oh, is that right?
When I was alumni secretary, I knew him through by mail.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember writing up this thing about him, that he had, that he was on the school board at that time and had served on the council. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when I, by the time I got to Cincinnati, he was dead. But those people are interesting. I guess one of the things that I'm interested in is the development of the political astuteness, or whatever you would call it, of the black people over your lifetime.
Well, the key political figure over my lifetime, of course, has been John Burton in terms of the black community.
Yeah.
But you've had on council, what's the guy's name? Charlie Jackson was on council for a term. See, we had two blacks on council for a while there when we were still at large elections.
Oh, yeah.
So, and that was one of the reasons that I didn't support that new charter that we passed back in 73, because there hadn't really been a specific problem in getting blacks on the council in Ypsilanti, because after the first one got elected, then, you know, blacks had regularly run and had been successful. Sam Bass was a member of council for either one or two terms. And then, of course, later in my era, Norman Kennedy and Paul Clay. And then up to the current time, of course, Doug Harris and Jerome Strong. But in terms of influence in a community, I've always felt that John Burton was a very important influence on my life, because he was in politics when I was a kid. And I watched and observed the workings of the city council and, you know, different things that were going on in the community as I was growing up.
Yeah.
But I was not here in the community at the time that he was elected mayor by the council, because that was during the time that I was in the service. And he was finishing up his term as mayor when I came back to Ypsilanti. I think he was the mayor for two terms. But in those days, of course, they were one-year terms. But the basic thing that I recall about black political involvement was that the black community learned well the lesson of how to vote when they went to vote in order to get the black to win. Because if you had three or four candidates running, and if a black candidate, was running, then they would go in there and vote for the black and leave.
Yeah.
And that was the only way that, they could get the black to win.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been astute about, that kind of business for, a long, long time.
Uh-huh.
On the school board, of course, I remember Dr. Perry. Dr. Perry was a very prominent black dentist in Ypsilanti, and he was my dentist, my family's dentist, up until his death. But again, was, very articulate, very bright, just kind of a slow-paced man, very deliberate when he had anything to say, and when he said it, he'd given a lot of thought to it. Wasn't particularly, outgoing or whatever. He wouldn't be the type that you would ask to stand up and give a big address anywhere, but was clearly a man that everybody listened to when he had something to say. And, of course, his daughter and his wife and so forth are right here still in the community making a good contribution, as well as his children.
Yeah.
They're not in Ipsy, besides Winnie, but Lowell I've known for all my life. Lowell's a few years older than I am, and the other Perry brother. But, well, I'd say that the school situation has been the most difficult in terms of blacks. We've, in recent year, in the past 15 years, I'd say, we've had a black on the school board. But up until, I'd say, the 50s, black participation as far as the Board of Education was concerned, other than Dr. Perry, wasn't there at all. Amos Washington, I don't remember what year he was on the school board. I don't remember whether it was council or the school board that he went to first.
Sleeping. Now let's see, we can take up where we got, why I got so sleepy I had to cut it off. Of course you grew up and went to college here, and what were some of the things you did while you were growing up?
Well, when I grew up, of course, I was active with the youth chapter of the NAACP. Mm-hmm. And I was quite active in the church at mm-hmm. that time. Participated in all of the different church groups for young people, and was involved in the district groups and so forth. And fought through the NAACP to integrate skating rinks in the local community, and was involved with the NAACP when we tried to go to bat to get the pictures removed from applications for employment and the dormitory applications at the university and things of that nature. When I was in high school, of course, I was quite active as a student leader in the high school because I was president of the student council. When I was a senior in high school, I was a member of the student council through high school, and you know, those kinds of things, basically, until I got into college. I wasn't really an athlete, so I didn't play any kind of athletics when I went to college. I played football in high school, but I was just sort of there. I wasn't wasn't particularly good at what I did. Then I, you know, went on to college, and went to ROTC.
Well, you did ROTC in college.
Yeah.
When did you and Judy meet? Mm-hmm. Did Judy go to high school with you?
No, she went to university school, and we met really when we were seniors in high school. And then we started dating latter part of the senior year in high school, and then we just sort of picked up from there, and both went to Eastern, so we continued dating one another there. And well, we got married after she finished her degree, but I had another semester to go, but then I stretched it into two because I didn't want to have to go on active duty when I got my commission in the middle of the year, so I just went worked full time and took my split load. Mm-hmm. I got my degree in 63. She finished in 62. And then in 60, and she taught for that first year down at Liberty School, Highland Park.
Oh, yeah.
Commuted back and forth, and we lived over in Mary Student Housing.
Oh, yeah.
Cornell Courts for a year. And then when I graduated and got my commission in 63, we left IPSI and went on active duty. Spent 3 years in Germany. And that's where George was born.
Yeah.
He was born in 65. And then we came back here in 66. Yeah. And then I got out of the service in February of 67. And started teaching at Roosevelt. And then the following, well, and then in July of 68, I started working over at the university. But I also was active when I was in college with the Young Democrats.
Oh, wow.
And, well, I've always more or less enjoyed politics and so forth. I studied, my major in college was political science.
Oh, yeah.
And I minored in history and sociology. Mm. But I really didn't have a real interest in history, per se, in the sense of some of the things that I'm now beginning to want to get into. You know, I just, I enjoyed studying history because I enjoyed reading about various things, but I never would have referred to myself as a historian, you know, by any stretch of the imagination.
Or as a history buff.
Or a history buff, right. But I have probably gained a much better and deeper appreciation of general history and certainly black history in the past 10 years.
Ah.
And I think some of that just comes with, you know, maturity and having had a combination of various experiences that were directly relevant to certain things that you've done in your life.
Now, when I got, because when I first got to know you, because I didn't get to know you, that's when I met you. And this some fella, whose name I don't remember, but you probably remember his name, who got in there and
divided the votes.
Decided to run and divided the vote.
Yeah, Jim Joe Lewis.
Right.
Well,
anyway, I remember that. That was the first incident I remember about you, because I remember from then on, I had a sort of a commitment. So whenever you did run, you were going to have my support. But I remember that particular instance, and I remember you were telling me about it. But now that must have been after we became neighbors.
Yeah,
I don't
probably
remember knowing
so.
You before that.
Yeah. Well, see, when you first came to town, the first time I ever remember meeting you was when you lived on Whittier in that big white house.
Yeah.
Staying
at
somebody's house while they were on
that
leave.
That was Walt Erickson's house.
And I think the first time I actually met you was during my campaign in 69.
Oh, yeah.
Because I came doing some door-to-door, and I had several names on a list of special people that I wanted to be sure to, you know, get to meet. Now, did you come to IPSI in 69 or 68?
Yeah, I came in 69.
69, yeah.
But the only people I know I met, see, I could have met, I couldn't remember exactly, but I was meeting so many people in those days.
Right.
But the one thing I do remember is that the Clammers had given me the Mansfields.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So even before I came here to go to work, when I was coming here to visit the school, to look at the school, I visited the Mansfields. And now, I would suspect that through the Mansfields, somewhere along in there, I met your mother and father.
Yeah, right.
But I can't remember exactly when.
Uh-huh.
And then I do remember that little incident. I remember that this guy had come in, and you had been planning to run, and you thought you would be the only person, and this guy comes in and files, and thereby divide the vote.
That's right.
And you said at that time he couldn't win, and he was going to keep you from winning.
Right.
Sure.
But I've also, over the years, of course, been involved in some international things, because My wife and I both were exchange students when we graduated from high school.
Oh, yeah.
Through Youth for Understanding. And up until about 3 years ago, I used to be on the board of directors. And then they moved to Washington.
Yeah.
Because their headquarters, of course, was in Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
But I have been involved in a lot of work with the organization, and I still get involved, you know, a little bit. I haven't done anything in the past couple of years directly with them,
yeah.
But I've had an opportunity to travel quite a bit as a result of my working with that particular group. And that through that, I have really, I have to give that particular experience an opportunity that I had credit as far as the way I feel about traveling in other countries. Of course, my family always traveled. My father always took a long vacation every summer, and we was gone for a month or 6 weeks. All the time, we were going someplace. And I can remember I was 11, I think. So yeah, the first time that we took a real long trip, I was 11 years old. And prior to that time, we would travel, but like we would go to visit some friends of theirs in New York. Well, as a matter of fact, Genevieve Williams' sister, Edith Bernard, mm-hmm. lives in New York. My parents were close friends with her, and we used to go to New York, and she lived right downtown in New York, practically. And this would have been in 51 when I was 11. It's the first time I went out west and saw, you know, all that stuff out there. Was very impressed, you know, with the West. But I've also had an opportunity to visit in a lot of foreign countries. And as a result, have taken my own kids to visit some of the foreign parts of the world. And we've been out west, but we haven't taken that driving tour, you know, across country. I've been to Oklahoma and Nevada and California and Washington and Oregon, Utah, and most of the southern states. And I really do believe that those kinds of experiences broaden one's perspectives tremendously in relationship to, you know, the tasks that they have performed in the community. Kind of opens up your vision a little bit.
Yeah. Well, of course, you had connected yourself with the Democratic Party while you were in school. What kindled your political interest after you got back? That you got out of city.
Well, when I came back to Ypsilanti,
that's when John Burton was mayor.
He was mayor, and I don't remember exactly the sequence of events, but at that time I was at the house one night, and he called up and asked me if I was interested in being appointed to the Human Relations Commission. And, of course, I said, yeah, I'd like that. And at that time, Mrs. Eaglin was also on the commission. Several other people, Marge Sansi and, you know, others that I can't recall all their names right offhand, but several people that I knew. And he basically said that you know, he wanted me to get back involved. Now, see, prior to that time, I also was appointed, in 1960, as a citizen member of the Citizens Advisory Committee for the Urban Renewal Program in Ypsilanti. And that's where I had my first contact with, my first sort of political contact with Mattie Dorsey. She was anti-urban renewal right down the wire. And I guess I was a college student, but I was also, you know, a Southside resident and kind of a homegrown entity, so that I brought a little balance, I guess, to the whole committee, because they had her on the one side fighting it, me on the other side. I shouldn't say that I was advocating for it, but I would try to bring some reason to some of the illogical arguments that she often came up with, you know. But then when I went away to the service, I was out of touch for 4 years, and then when I came back, John Burton found out that I was back in town, and he, you know, contacted me again and said that he wanted me to get involved with this Human Relations Commission. So I served on the Human Relations Commission for 2 years, and then I was elected the chairman the second year that I was on. And then I had been asked by, you know, John Burton and several other people to consider running for council in that 69 council race. But my own personal interest has always been, you know, revolving around politics and the political world, and that particular sequence of events provided me the opportunity then to get back into it. But now, had someone asked me in 1969 if I would have expected or thought that within a matter of 2 years I would have been the mayor, I would have clearly said no, because at that time that wasn't one of my... I can't say it wasn't an aspiration, but it wasn't something that I saw that was coming on the horizon that quickly. Because when I got on council, you see, I was in a clear minority, because Norman Kennedy and I were serving on council together. We lost on just about everything, because the Republicans were solidly in charge. But I was a threat. I was a real threat to the Republicans, and particularly to the mayor at that time, who was Boatwright, because they tried to, you know, roll things past and didn't really want to have no whole lot of discussion about things. And although I would realize that I was going to be on the losing end of votes, I'd raise questions in the meetings. And so they tried to placate my activity by giving me certain kinds of responsibility. That's the only reason I was elected mayor pro tem. They figured, well, they better hand this dude something, because shut him up, see? When I got to be the mayor pro tem, I just continued just like I was all along. But then some of the others that were around the table started to take up more support on various things. And when Nat got appointed to the council, although she was a Republican, we really ended up, we had some battles on a couple of things, yeah. But basically we ended up supporting one another's positions on things more than I got support from some of the others around the council table. And it's pretty much the way it is today, as far as the, you know, city council is concerned. I'm a Democrat and she's a Republican, but in terms of local Ypsilanti city issues, you just can't break them down into party distinctions that clearly, because they're not a party issue. It's just a community issue.
Of course, you have had, since being on the council, you have had some, I mean, since the time you was elected to council, you've had some pretty good experiences, I guess, call them good. You've had some challenging times, I know.
Right.
And you've had some good times that have been rather, I don't like to call them threatening, but there have been experiences that you'd rather not have.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, since you've been on the council, what strikes you as perhaps the most pleasant kind of thing that has happened to you?
Well, as it relates directly to Ypsilanti, I would say that I the most pleasant thing that happened to me initially was when my own council colleagues elected me mayor in 1972. That was before the charter changed. And, you know, it was clearly obvious that as a result of that particular election in 72, that had it not been for a couple of newcomers on the council who had already committed to themselves, but neither of them had said it to me, that they really felt that I was best qualified to get the job. And they really broke through, I think, some significant odds that they had to deal with in the community, because, you know, I was still a black man.
Yeah, still black, and that was at that particular time in history.
In that time in history, things just hadn't opened up as greatly where you could expect that sort of thing to, you know, occur.
Yeah.
And so when that happened, of course, that was clearly one of the highlights. I guess then, of course, I came back and ran on my own accord at large that following year, you know, when the charter changed. But now, in terms of things that have happened to me that have been particularly pleasant since that time, I mean, there's just been a, you know, there's been a lot of things that clearly I view as pleasant, good, make me feel good, versus, you know, the problems. When we had the decision made to build the first senior citizens high rise, I had spent an awful long time trying to get that thing off the ground at Ypsilanti. And when I stood up down there and gave a few words at the groundbreaking where we were digging dirt to get that thing started, I felt very good about that. I felt good about the swimming pool project. I felt good when we were able to finally get that vote to move City Hall from the old building down to where we are now. So there's really been, you know, kind of several things that I would have to identify as having been, you know, very pleasant experiences. Now, there are little things that happen that mean a lot more to me than some of the big things by way of, you know, the usual awards or recognitions that you get. And little things, for example, are when someone calls me and I try to do them a favor or respond to their request, and then somehow or another they communicate directly back to me, or they send me a note thanking me for having helped them.
Yeah.
Because very rarely do you get that.
Yeah.
And when it happens, obviously, then you just feel very good about that person, because you realize how infrequent it is that an individual is ever appreciative of things that happen to them. But the experience of being in the mayor's chair and having the experience of meeting people and, you know, certainly dealing with officials at in Washington, in my experiences and opportunities that I had through the Michigan Municipal League were certainly all highlights in terms of my years that I've been in office. It would probably be very difficult for me to single out one event
or
one series of things that I would say I felt, you know, better about than others.
I recall one incident when you were out of town. I was trying to remember who the mayor pro tem was. But I recall that in the discussion that was taking place, own the issue. But you not being there, and the other person, oh, that was the guy that finally was defeated and wouldn't run again.
He was on council then?
And he ran against you one time.
Hooker. Yeah, he ran for mayor against
you. Yeah. But before that, I remember, wasn't he Mayor Pro Tem?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember whatever it was that came up, he could not hound the meeting.
Yeah.
And everybody was just saying they'd be so glad when you came back that you could hound the meeting. And of course, sure enough, it did happen just like that. Of course, I think we always thought that was perhaps one of the main reasons he had such a poor showing in the election. Because even though I doubt very much if it were planned that way.
Yeah.
But while you were away, that was an opportunity for him to be shown up as unequal to the job. And by the same score, when you came back, you were disabled. I always thought, to me, that's a high point in my recollection of a political event which involved you. Mm-hmm. Just that ability to come back and somehow work that thing out and to keep those people at each other away from each other's throats, because they're always doing that anyway.
Well, I do recall there was two or three times when I had to be away. I was out of town. And that was, of course, a very difficult period in the community, because that's when we had that three-party council. We had HRPs and Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah.
And I remember that they had a big meeting down there one night where the HRP wanted to show a movie picture about something, marijuana or whatever the issue was. And he slammed the gavel down on the glass and broke the glass. Said no, they wasn't going to show no pictures down here tonight, and this meeting was adjourned. And I guess all bedlam broke out in the council chambers, and folks was running and jumping. And I remember Paul Clay was telling me later that he was getting ready to go out there and grab one of those little hippies and throw him out of the council chamber. But those were clearly times when you definitely needed to have a good head on your shoulder and you could maintain your composure, because everybody else was losing their head.
Yeah.
And if you lost yours as the leader, there was no control.
Yeah.
And that's precisely what happened that particular evening, I guess. And things just, came to a screeching halt. And, of course, the next morning at 6:30 in the hotel room, I get a call, and Hooker's on the phone telling me all about what happened and so forth and so on. And the incident that I can remember also was the time that the council was getting organized. I was in Washington, a State Department briefing that I had been invited to. And they were trying to elect the mayor pro tem. And they sat down there until midnight casting ballots to determine who the mayor pro tem was going to be. And they came to a deadlock. They ended up with a 5-5 tie. And no one except my wife and Dale Hooker knew exactly when I was due to come back to Ypsilanti. But see, I was due to come back that next evening. And they adjourned that council meeting on a Monday night. And Tuesday night, they had agreed to reassemble at 7 o'clock and start the balloting all over again. And my plane landed in Detroit at 7:05. And my wife met me at the airport, and I walked out to the car, and she said, "Get in the car, because you got to get to Ipsy, because you got to go down there and run this council meeting." And I said, "What do you mean, run a council meeting?" She says, "Well, they didn't elect your mayor pro tem last night." So I said, "All right." And she brought the Ipsy paper out to the airport so I could read everything that everybody said the night before. And about 7:45, we pulled up front of City Hall, and I just told her to keep the car, and I'd get a ride home with somebody. And I walked up the steps, and it was relatively quiet in the room because they were in the middle of casting ballots, and they had been through about 10 ballots by that time, or 10 votes, rather. And they still ended up with 5-5 tie. And Jim Ashby was the city clerk, and he was, of course, sitting in the mayor's chair because they didn't have anybody that could act as the mayor because they hadn't elected a mayor pro tem yet. And I opened the door and walked in the room, and when everybody saw me walk in that room, it was just like, you know, the weight had been lifted from everybody's shoulders, because they knew that when I got there, I'd just sit down and resume. And so I sat down at the table, and I asked Jim Ashby where we were, and he said, well, we are on about the 10th or 11th vote for this mayor pro tem thing. I said, all right. So then I said, the floor is open for nominations for mayor pro tem. Well, the battle came down between Hooker and Waldemeyer. And Waldemeyer had managed to talk some of the young HRP into voting for him. And Hooker had talked Democrats into voting for him. So they had split the Democrats up and the HRP up so that effectively Hooker had, you know, 5 votes and Waldemeyer had 5 votes. So mine was the
tiebreaker. Yeah.
Well, of course, I had worked with Waldemeyer already, and I just didn't believe that he was the caliber to handle that kind of job, plus some other things that I had general concerns about with him. And I had at least been more successful in working with Hooker because he had supported some of the things that I wanted to do while I was in the mayor's chair. So we got the nominations on the floor and we had to vote, and it was over. 6-5 vote. Hooker was in the mayor pro tem. I said, swear him in, and the meeting's adjourned. And all that happened in a matter of 5 minutes after I walked into the room.
I remember that. But we were just so proud of the fact that you had, you know, you could handle it like that.
And I guess when I recall things that happen, it just points out how the person that's involved in certain situations don't put a heavy emphasis, or they don't have a particular recognition of that event as, you know, having any more significance than a whole lot of other kinds of events that have occurred. Because I guess I would have probably never made a, I wouldn't have even recalled that particular incident as a part of something that was particularly significant to me as I look at my experience over these past 10 years. But I do recognize and I do appreciate that there are others who watch these little things that occur and manage to put them in context as it relates to, you know, the overall picture down there.
Well, you know, yeah, I remember that. And I guess the other thing I wanted is, how have your so-called, what I would call, public works brought you satisfaction? When I say public works, I'm talking about things like the bridge, the highway intersections.
Right.
You've had to deal with those, I know, several times.
Mm-hmm.
How does your satisfaction with those stack up?
Well, I'm, of course, very pleased with some of those public works projects that we were able to get accomplished. You know, we've been working very long now to get those bridges in. We finally managed to do that. And that, particularly that bridge down there by the Ford Motor Company, that's been a long time.
Sure has been. Long time.
It's incredible the amount of work that you have to do work with these different elected officials, these different bureaucrats, Washington and state level and so forth to get those things off the ground. And very definitely, I'm very happy about those things. Getting the street widened, getting the promenade in, getting the depot town thing in, the farmer's market. Those are all things that, to me at least, are going to help our community, you know, continue to prosper, or at least set the stage for expanded opportunities for business development in the next 10 years. So I would certainly rank some of those sorts of things on a list of accomplishments, I guess I would say, in the sense of they occurred during the time and under the leadership that I've been trying to bring to the community.
Well, I had another question I was going to ask you a while ago. Have you decided what you want to do once you're out of that thing?
Future ambitions?
Yep. Future plans, future ambitions. I know you ran for state senate. Once,
right.
Very strongly losing project. Unfortunate opposition at that particular time.
Yeah. Well, I haven't really made any particular decision about what I'm going to do in the future. I enjoy the political world. I certainly would probably consider running for another public office at some time, if the right combinations of opportunities came along. I frankly am at a point where I am getting a little tired of dealing with this mayor's role. I'm kind of, you know, betwixt and between about it, because on the one hand, I just sort of like to be able to bow out, let somebody else get involved, and maybe spend a little time just having my job at the university and just kind of doing some other things. But then when I look at the folks coming along and the people that I see out in the community and the kind of discussions that I have with people who keep urging me to stay in there and do this, do that, do the other thing, it just raises enough ambivalence about the issue as to whether I should or shouldn't stop right now.
Yeah.
If I had confidence at this moment that I could foresee on the horizon an individual who I had a lot of, you know, respect for that would have a reasonable chance of winning in the election, that I think would be certainly good for the community, I would not at all mind bowing out and just spending a little time looking to see what other political opportunities might open up. And in some situations, you can be more effective depending on how you can function when you're not sitting right there at the head of the table all the time, you know. But I haven't made any firm decision yet as to whether I'm going to seek re-election again. I got another year, so.
Yeah.